Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is the House Committee on Revenue. Today is the 25th of May. It's about 6 minutes after one, and we are starting about 6 minutes late. Colleagues, we've got a number of issues to take care of today. What we'll do is let's start, please, a little out of order again. I hope that doesn't offend anyone. But we're going to start with House Bill 2234. That's probably the most complex or more complex of these two enterprise zones. Mary, can you bring us up to date on 2234?
Yes, Mr. Chair. 2234 has several provisions to it, and the original, I have a summary sheet in front of you, and to just give an overview to those in the audience who aren't familiar with it, the original 2234A removed restrictions on the number of e-commerce zones that could be designated, changed the sunset provisions for long-term enterprise zones from 2006 to 2009, and effective, it goes into effect on the 91st day after the date of the regular session of the 73rd Legislative Assembly adjourns. Cindy?
Sign it out.
Sunday.
That's close enough.
The Dash 4 amendment was an extension of that. It retains the original 2234 version, removes the limitations on the number of, however, it removes the number of the limitations on the number of e-commerce zones that could be designated. And it retains that and delays the effective date. So it's just like the A version, except the effective date is longer. The I want to flip to the Dash 7 amendment because it flows very nicely that way. It removes from the engrossed version that went to the floor and came back here for a clarification. It removes from that the engrossed version the language that eliminates restrictions on e-commerce zones and the number of e-commerce zones that may be designated after the effective date, and it allows the designation of 6 additional e-commerce zones on or after July 1, 2006. The effective date is still the same as the A amendment. It also retains, retains the provision that the long-term enterprise zones sunset date will change from 2006 to 2009. So in short, the Dash B amendment basically is identical to the 223A amendment, except that it reduces the number of e-commerce zones that can be designated after July 1, 2006.
Okay, so B7, as I've gone through and filled in my copy of the B engrossed, what it does is it deletes all of Section 1, and then it deletes Sections 3 and 4 on the back page. And then it inserts the language for the new and renumbers Section 2 on the face page, inserting number 1 and number 2, Sections 1 and 2. And I'm going to have to find my copy of that now.
So we get the being gross and the piece.
Okay, and that's from the counties. Doris Pinwheel brought us the information. That moves, by moving the B7 section in Section 1, you move up to a total of 10 electronic commerce zones. And even though this bill now becomes effective 91st day after sine die, the first e-commerce zone can only be applied for under the Dash B7 amendments through the OECDD on or after July 1st, 2006. So the first opportunity that anyone would have to come into these additional 6 e-commerce enterprise zones would be on July 1st, 2006, with tax returns ending June 30, 2007. And so, Mary, you've got a fiscal...
Tell me
what the fiscal, or the revenue, rather, the revenue shows for 2005-2007 as being $100,000. That would be estimated tax payments, which would be adjusted.
The revenue impact. $10,000.
I'm sorry, $10,000.
Correct. And in 07-09, it would be, this is property tax impact of $80,000.
Wait a minute.
$8,000.
That's revenue. That's property tax. You're
mm-hmm.
actually correct.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And the corporate income tax estimate for 05-07 is $180,000. And 07-09, it's $4.5 million.
Reductions in both of those periods.
Correct. And these assumptions are based on the assumptions are that between 05-06 and FY-10-11, there'll be 20 new projects based on the creation of six additional zones, e-commerce zones, and they will be approved and operational during that period. The average investment, based on historical averages, will be about $1.3 million per project, and this amount I'm going to assume or have assumed would grow annually by 5%. And based on historical averages for property taxes in existing enterprise zones, the average property tax exemption amount will be about $3,000 per year, which I have assumed will grow annually by 3%.
So 20 new projects by the end of 09, is that right?
Well, I've stretched them out until 10-11.
Okay.
Based on the profile that I saw
through
from history.
2010-2011. 20 new projects. What are the number of new jobs that might create?
I don't have that
ratio. Did you factor any of that in? This is all corporate income tax reduction. You didn't do any dynamic modeling with
regard to. Okay. No, Mr. Chair. Thank you for mentioning that. This would probably be the maximum impact because as soon as you see a revenue reduction, there have to be people employed. Correct.
Right.
And then, therefore, there would be some offset, but I don't have the model to do
Why are you looking at me when you ask? I don't know if I'm supposed to say yes.
I think she's actually kind of looking.
Is the reason for the lower revenue hit because things start at a later time?
I'm not sure, Representative Paz. You mean the lower revenue hit offset? You mean the offset?
I'm sorry, the offset.
Okay. The offset, Representative Paz, would be because at the same time you've got these liabilities that you're taking tax credit for and property tax exemptions. The building must be operational. People would have had to have been hired and working. So they're generating personal income, which isn't actually an offset against corporate. It's an offset against total, if you were looking at combined total and personal income tax. But we have a corporate income tax model that can generate a dynamic, estimate, mm-hmm. and I do not have it. Oh.
I'm wondering why it was so much, it was half.
I'm responding now to Representative Haas's question about the revision correction to the statement on the A4, which became the effect of being engrossed, that was passed out on 4/28/05. And this became the B engrossed, and originally I was interpreting that very differently. I had looked at not the printed version of the bill. I had looked at instructions of what was going to happen, but when you actually looked at the printed version, it wasn't a merge of other amendments. Okay, it was actually very simplified to only six. Okay, this number would have been more pertinent to more complicated assumptions about the bill, about what the bill was going to do.
Okay.
But at this point, Mary, we don't have the individual income tax, the positive individual income tax effects of potentially 20 new projects statewide by, we've got through 709, excuse me, but we don't have it through 2011.
That is correct, Mr. Chair.
Do we have any idea how many representatives, Esquivel, you have some of these e-commerce in your district, many, as I understand. What would you say was the average employment in one of these? As I recall, you had talked about the number of jobs that your mayor, had.
What I have and I passed on was that you had created with the 32 applications for the zones and the approximate capital investment of $79.7 million within the community itself, we've created approximately 1,322 jobs, but more importantly, we retained 3,491 jobs. So actually, the effect of this is 4,813 jobs is the total effect, because you have two. You know, you have retention and expansion is what you have.
So if we just looked at, let's say approximately 40 had created 1,300 new jobs, then 20 might create 650 new jobs. Are those family wage jobs represented?
I don't have that information to be candid with you. I do not have that information. Okay. The average is about 150 jobs per operation. Per application.
Okay. So
that's including retention and expansion. So there is two different things.
So if you had 20 of them at 150 jobs, expansion and retention, that would be potentially 3,000 jobs, both expanded and retained. And we don't have that information. We just have the corporate income tax cost. And the property tax reduction, does the property tax reduction of $80,000 in the 07-09 include any of the property tax increases that there will be as a result of the fact that to build these, they do have some non, let's see, or are these fully excludable under the enterprise zone? The entire portion would be excludable for what, 3 years or 5 years?
I think it's 3 to 5, depending upon
three to
what
five,
the stipulations are on their on their creation, job creation.
All right. So at that particular point, all of these new ones would be totally off the tax records. Representative Riley?
It's 3 years with a 2-year extension.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Fair enough. All right. Thank you very much. I'd like to have Deborah Buchanan. Deborah, will you come up on the Dash 6 amendment? Dash 6 amendment is, I think, very important for us to understand, and it's a clarification. There is no fiscal impact of the Dash 6.
That is correct, not incrementally. If it's added to one of the other bills, well, then, of course, the total is the same, but there's no incremental impact from this particular.
Deborah?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, our attorneys identified an issue with a different tax credit, not one you've been talking about at all. It's the long-term enterprise zone credit. And the amendment is clarifying existing language, making a technical correction that they advised should be done. I can sum it up in perhaps two sentences and then try to explain it. The current law provides, the language says that credits cannot be offset against a tax credit threshold amount, And what the attorney said is you never offset credits against a threshold amount. You offset it against your tax liability. So this amendment says you cannot offset credits against the tax liability up to the tax credit threshold amount. So it's making that change. The second change is that the law requires that we transfer certain payments into a fund, and this is clarifying that if the payments don't come in, we're not required to transfer anything. So in other words, if the money isn't there, we're not required to transfer. That's essentially what the amendments to this bill do.
So the Dash 6 addresses Section 317.129 in part, the long-term enterprise zone. The long-term enterprise zone says, or in that long-term enterprise zone, the tax credit threshold before you start to take the tax credits have to be up to $1 million, and then there's some specialized things that you do with that $1 million. It's my understanding no one's taking advantage, or no one has been able to take advantage of this at this time.
Mr. Chairman, the credit is administered by Economic and Community Development, and I'm sure they would correct me if I'm wrong, but to my knowledge, the credit has not been claimed to date.
Okay. And then the B6 amendment clarifies the ordering of the credits and the threshold, and then this special account that would be used for the transferring.
Colleagues,
questions for Deborah on the dash six for Ms. Buchanan. Thank you very much,
Deborah.
I found very helpful your worksheet, Deborah. That is most helpful. Thank you very much. Representative Berger, I would entertain a motion regarding the dash six.
I move the dash six amendments to B and Gross.
That's
2234.
It shows B and Gross at this point, so these are the B six.
Yeah, so there would be the B six amendments.
The motion is to move the dash six amendment B and Gross to House Bill 2234. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. For the record, there's full complement of all members present. The dash seven are much more complex, as you understand, and deal with those items that staff has taken us through today. Yes, Representative Berger?
Could I ask a question of staff? Just in my own mind, what are... Maybe it's restriction. What are the difference between the B7s and the original A and Gross bill?
The A removes the restrictions on the number of e-commerce zones that can be created.
And the B7?
Says we're going to increase the existing enterprise, electronic enterprise zones by six.
Six additional to a total of 10.
Okay, six adds.
But effective July 1st, 2006 would be
instead of
sooner.
2009.
No, I think the 2008 was also effective on the
Sinai.
Okay.
But it did have that provision, and I corrected myself. That both bills have the provision that the sunset date for long-term enterprise zones. That's different from the electronic enterprise zones. That second provision, the deal that deals with the 2006 change to 2009 on a sunset date, that's basically to bring all of the enterprise zone sunset dates into alignment with one another.
Got it.
Okay.
Okay. Now I'm
further questions of staff on the dash seven, colleagues. We're not dealing with easy items here because this has gone through several iterations and this will be printed C and Gross before it hits the floor now.
Okay.
So again, the dash seven removes the language that eliminates the restrictions on the number of the e-commerce zones may be designated after the effective date of the Act, bringing those to a total of designated six additional e-commerce zones, which the soonest that they could begin, and that would be after they have jumped through the hurdles with have filed and have made the designation after filing with the Economic and Community Development Department on or after July 1st, 2006, and then this all becomes effective the 31st day after adjournment of this. And the 31st day after adjournment would be sooner than July 1st, 2006, we hope.
It better be.
And that would be the date of that then this bill would be effective. Other questions then on the dash seven? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash seven B engrossed B seven amendments to 2234.
Okay, you've heard the motion. Further discussion on the motion.
I just can't resist. That means I have a bingo.
B7.
I have
B7. B7.
I was thinking of
B7. Yeah. One of you is thinking about health and the other one's thinking about fun. That's a good combination, colleagues. Is there any objection to the adoption of the B7? Hearing and seeing no objection, we will enter the B7 as adopted and append the B7 amendments to House Bill 2234. Colleagues, the bill is now amended, 2234, ready to go back to the floor one more time. If we can pass it, and it's in its current amended form, Representative Galizio.
I just had, can I ask a couple questions?
You bet.
Mary? Voice over internet protocol, right? That technology where you could use the internet as kind of as a telephone?
Yes.
So my question is, since the definition of e-commerce, and I assume that has not changed.
No, not to
right.
my knowledge.
Okay. A substantial portion of the commerce, i.e. 51% of the transactions, have to take place over the internet. So would phone calls using voice over internet constitute or fall under that?
Do I have an expert? Do I have an expert in the audience? Everybody's looking at the back wall. Art, can you come up, please? Come up to the.
Poor guy.
Thank you very much, Art, for making yourself available.
Harris is coming up too.
Does this mean I don't know?
No. Chair Butler, Representative Galizio, members of the committee. Again, it's a pleasure to be here. My name is Arthur Fish with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department. And that's a good question, but the language is really, you know, if they're using the internet as a platform, I guess it really wouldn't matter whether the information is appearing on a screen in a typed or textual area or if it's coming voice over the internet. The 51% is really just, you know, when are they doing enough over the internet to, you know, count as, you know, e-commerce? I mean, the predominantly e-commerce language that the department's charged with trying to decipher. And I would say if their voice is coming over the internet, the language about, you know, is just that you're doing transactions over the internet or on a computer platform that's based on the internet. So I would think if it's voice or text, it wouldn't matter. That would be that would contribute
okay,
to it being more e-commerce. Yeah.
So a conversation over the telephone using voice over internet would be a transaction.
If that's
can
the
I
way
have a cheeseburger and fries would be a transaction.
That's a good question. But I don't think
are they going to set up in an e-commerce zone?
If they're going to set up in an e-commerce zone and they're using, you know, the internet as the method, I would think, you know,
and
it doesn't matter.
Be what percentage are?
We say as long as it's more than 50% internet based, you know, the e-commerce, then we'll treat it as an e-commerce business.
So follow up, Representative Galizio.
I'm sorry. Follow up.
Yeah.
So your answer is no.
My
cheeseburger and fries. Because the internet, if voice over internet protocol, you're using the internet, the platform,
mm-hmm.
as a telephone line, that would, so I get.
Yeah, but you'd have to be, the business would have to be working, receiving it off the internet. I mean, if it's just the customer using a telephone that's internet based, that, you know, and they're just receiving it over a telephone line and listening to it.
If the business is using that platform for
yes.
their telephone,
yes.
then
that would count towards
okay.
the
All
51%,
right.
yeah. Yeah, does that help?
And the hamburger would, too.
Yeah.
Would not.
No.
Another
follow-up, Representative
Galizio. Yeah. And then on the employment issue.
Right.
So
yeah,
okay. My understanding is jobs must increase by 10% incrementally in that location.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Representative Galizio, Chair Butler, members of the committee. They have to use the standard enterprise zone property tax exemption program. So to use that program, you have to increase your existing employment by one job or 10%, whichever is greater. If you're using that program and you're an e-commerce business in an e-commerce zone, then you can also access the additional tax credit. But you do have to qualify under the property tax program to begin with, which carries that requirement.
Follow up. So the job must be in that location. In other words, in enterprise zone in Medford,
mm-hmm.
the job increase must be someone employed in Medford.
Chair Butler, Representative Galizio, members of the committee, that's correct. And, you know, the examples would be, you know, we have businesses down there, some of which are new, and, of course, they're just creating, you know, potentially only one job, but, you know, possibly quite a bit more. But if they have 20 people, they have to add two more people that are working full-time year-round in the enterprise zone. If they have 500 people, they have to go up to at least 550 people working full-time year-round in the enterprise zone. Does that help?
It does. One more?
Follow-up. Yes, sir. Representative?
I watched Matlock last night, so.
Get a life.
Nick at Night, yes. However, it is feasible. It is possible. I'm not saying this is going to happen. This is what we're promoting, but you could add one or two jobs in Medford and yet add 80 jobs in another country or in another state and still meet the criteria. As long as you're increasing the employment in Medford by 10, and I don't mean to pick on Medford where there are $220 million homes, 10% incremental increase, as long as you're doing that, and then 51% of your transactions are over the Internet, employing, you know, 800 people in another country or another state, you would still be allowed this tax break.
Representative Galizio, Chair Butler, members of the committee, some of these companies obviously are global. I mean, that's kind of one of the advantages of getting involved with e-commerce is that, you know, you can be easily global. So, yeah, they could be doing something in the enterprise zone where they're increasing by two jobs or 20 jobs or 200 jobs, whatever the case may be, respective to the minimum that the law requires to use to access the program. And yet the company may be doing something else in California, in Calcutta, in any place around the world that may or may not relate to what they're doing here in our enterprise zone. Whether that's, I don't know if there's anything wrong with that or necessarily positive. I mean,
the credit is based upon the amount that's invested in the enterprise zone.
Correct, Chair Butler, members of the committee. The credit is only equal to 25% of the capital assets that are used for e-commerce and located in the e-commerce enterprise zone. So it's all proportioned and stipulated based on things that are actually happening and occurring in one of these designations.
So if I am a company of 100 employees located in a enterprise zone with an e-commerce overlay with 100 employees, and I move my operations so that they will now have 110 full-time employees at that location, and I invest $10 million additional dollars at that location into property plant equipment for high-tech communications, and I add 800 jobs in Bangladesh, then the Bangladesh operation has nothing to do, neither profit-wise, nor jobs-wise, nor credit-wise, nor investment-wise, with regard to the business in the e-commerce enterprise zone.
Correct.
Okay. And then if I demonstrate a profit, a corporate profit, off of the direct activity in the state of Oregon, in the enterprise zone, and the e-commerce overlay, and that profit happens to be $100 million, so that I'm paying tax of let's say, $6 million, then I would be entitled to up to $2.5 million. That's 25% of my direct investment.
And then I would, it maxes out at $2
million. Maxes out at $2 million, okay, with a max of $2 million, not to exceed $2 million per project.
Per project.
That's over the life of the project, or over the...
Per project per year.
Per year. Okay. Okay. Further questions?
Matlock rests.
Okay. Representative Hass.
Quick questions. The definitions you use about the 50%, are those in rule?
Yeah, I mean, it's based on the language that you'll find in, actually, ORS 285C050, and I was dyslexic the other day. It was really 315507 is where the tax credit is. But in 505, where we talk about e-commerce and e-commerce zones, it talks about, you know, businesses that are predominantly engaged in e-commerce, which means transactions on the Internet. And we've determined that 50% or, you know, more than 50% gets to predominantly.
So you could update those definitions to stay with the intent of this law while technology, you know, passes us.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's one of the advantages. I mean, you know, we wouldn't do it willy nilly, but yes.
Right. And are you supportive of these amendments, the B7s? This is the department's bill. So.
Well, yes. To be quite honest, the B7s return the bill to where we initially introduced or requested an introduction of a bill to add, to increase the number from 4 to 10, because. You know, when these zones were first put out there in 2002, we had, say, 14 enterprise zone sponsors come up with applications, and we tried to pick the best four, but that's not fun, and because you have to turn 10 away. And we know, we've done some surveying, we know probably 16 or more would eagerly seek new designations. So we're trying to serve our sponsors, local city and county governments, that would like to add this aspect to their existing enterprise zones. And we think 6 is a good starting point. We were supportive of efforts by the Trade and Economic Committee to entertain larger amounts, and they decided to go all the way to the maximum of total enterprise zones. And you know, whatever pleases the committee, we're fully in support of.
Yeah. Art, this bill, I haven't seen anything, but it's probably embedded in the language within the current e-commerce. What a competition. Is there a possibility that Eugene applies for and receives the benefit of one of these, if they can get into a enterprise zone, and then they apply for an e-commerce zone and receive that, can they attract business away from Medford at that point, or from Roseburg, where they have some of this benefit?
Well, that's a good question, Chair Butler, members of the committee. And it actually, there was just one little thing in your whole thing. If you're moving jobs, beyond more than 30 miles away from an enterprise zone into the enterprise zone, then you essentially can't use the enterprise zone.
Okay.
So that would essentially cancel, basic property tax exemption, which is a required, predicate to using the tax credit.
That's what I was concerned about, was I don't want to disadvantage any community in this process just shifting things around in order to get a tax credit.
But, of course, if other zones have this, they'll be more competitive against companies that have a choice.
Exactly.
Of course.
Exactly.
You
for new businesses that would want to come and take advantage of it. Further questions of Art, Mr. Fish? Thank you very much,
Thank
Art.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. So, colleagues, we've had a discussion now on the dash B7 to House Bill 2234. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2234 as amended with the B7 and the B6 to the House floor again with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, the motion is to move House Bill 2234. As amended with B6 and B7 amendments thereto to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion to the motion? Is there any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing no objection to the motion, we will order the due pass to the floor. And Representative Riley, you and I carried that last time, or attempted to. Do you want to do that again? Or
sure.
Do we have so much fun? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I would ask that we take the time at this time to identify which documents in these packets actually specify these amendments. My packet is getting so big.
Excellent. Representative, I'm going to assign Mary Ayala from the Legislative Revenue Office to make sure that each one of us have a completed document in our file, stapled, which will include the C engrossed version of it, and everything that will apply to the C engrossed version. And will give us the history on this one right here, which we'll be able to refer to.
History?
Yes, including the history that got us here. So, Mary, if you'll do that, and I'm looking to Legislative Revenue Officer Paul Warner to make sure that gets done. Thank you. With that, colleagues, we will then close the work session on House Bill 2234, and we will open a work session on House Bill 3143. Mary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 3143A and subsequent amendments are before you with in a summary format. For those of you who are not familiar with the bill, I'll give you sort of a recap. The 3143A authorizes the Department of Economic and Community Development to approve designation of up to 10 additional urban or non-urban enterprise zones, raising the limit to 59 enterprise zones. It allows special taxing districts to elect not to participate in zone designation. This provision, which checked with general counsel, and I referenced it here, will only pertain to the 10 new enterprise zones. So existing enterprise zones will continue until they expire. They could be redesignated elsewhere, but they would not fall under the provision of the opt-out that's proposed here for 10 new enterprise zones.
So the bill as it came to us, 3143, as Ann Grosch, came from, was that representing Trade and Economic Development?
Yes, it was.
And Representative Riley sits on that, where he has had the advantage of having heard this bill in its various iterations in the past. So it came with an additional opt-out provision for local governments, and let's see, and it had 10 additional urban or non-urban enterprise zones.
And the opt-out is approved. The opt-out, Mr. Chair, is restricted to the 10 new zones.
Right, and it stays with those 10 zones and is with those 10 zones only from this point forward based upon this current provision. Now, we've got, I understand that there are three different amendments that are still in play, A7, A8, and A9. A7 came from OECDD, which in effect drops it to 3 and then backs out the opt-out provision. The AA drops it to 3, and that came from the counties. Raises the limit. Let's see, up from the 3 additional, and raises the limit to 52 enterprise zones. Let's see, that's still three. You're right. But deletes the opt-out provision and adds a section which would then enable the sponsor of the enterprise zone to consider allowing fees for provisions of local services to the property located in enterprise zones. And then the A9 amendment, which comes from the Coquille Nation, basically eliminates one of the eligible requirements on reservation enterprise zones, which states that the population density of the reservation may not exceed 15 persons per square mile, which would then make enterprise zones, assuming that our Indian nations, our Native American nations, sovereigns within the state of Oregon, could then all qualify once they made the necessary application and qualified the 15 persons per square mile. Would not hamper them in making that application. Right now, it's my understanding that only the Umatilla qualifies as a result of that amendment that's on the or that provision that's on the reservation enterprise zones. Colleagues, those three that are in play. Previously, the A6 was in play, and it's my understanding it no longer is. OECDD proposes the A7. Counties A8 and the A9 is from the Coquille Nation. Comments regarding, first of all, I think Representative Riley, I would like to have the benefit of your input relative to the conversation and the testimony which was given relative to the opt-out provisions that were added in your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we had some very very good testimony from Mr. Roberts, Jack Roberts, and he was very persuasive. He, in his opinion, feels that the opt-out is a good thing, and that it will cause the agencies to have better conversation, and felt that the if the agency, the county, the city, whoever the agency is, could not convince those, then maybe it was not a good deal. I tend to agree with that. I think there's some evidence for that in the vertical housing projects that we've seen. Oregon City testified in front of us about that, and it's a very similar situation. They went to all of their special districts, convinced every one of them that it was a good thing, and they all agreed and got on board. If they get on board voluntarily, it seems much better to me than being forced on board. And I think that you have the option.
And you did that. They did that early on, bringing all of the people, all of the players to the table.
Right.
Colleagues, I tend to agree with Representative Riley relative to the fact that these particular 10 districts could be then separate and distinct, in that they would not they would have a local opt-out provision, and I believe that by putting this through the test with this opt-out provision, the local taxing district's opt-out provision, that what could happen is that a new generation, a new era starts with regard to communications between larger governmental entities and smaller governmental entities. That these 10 separate and distinct enterprise zones, that with the opt-out provisions, that a greater level of communication would be ongoing between the parties. And so that would then make the need for the A7s and the A8s not necessary for this discussion at that point. Comment? Representative Comment?
Thanks, Chairman Butler. The only comment that I have, as you stated, you know, if we go with the opt-out, this is something new and different. I don't know how amendments, I don't think we probably can do this, but my preference would be just to have, you know, 3 new participants versus the 10. If that was, you know, when we're doing something that's new and to see how it works, but I don't know if we can adjust amendments as we go.
That would require an additional amendment, Representative Comp. That's an excellent observation. Why do you need 10 if it's an experiment?
Right.
And one thing is that if the experiment does not work and no one uses them, then they'll go away. If the experiment works and the result is that local governments will communicate one with another, and we won't have people coming in last minute to say, we've decided to go ahead and do this, and have a small local district say, folks, we can't supply water. We can't
right.
give you the fire protection that you want to do what it is that you've decided that you want to do. Then at that particular point, then the folks are going to have to come back and say, we can't go with our project unless we have the support of the water district, the sewer district, the fire suppression district, and those kinds of things. It brings them back, as I say, a new level, a heightened level of communication. Representative Riley?
It also gives them another option in this case, Mr. Chair, where if the fire department says, we can't provide this additional fire protection without this additional revenue, then the local district has the option, if they can convince the folks that are wanting to come in, to go ahead without the fire district participating, and they will have that fire protection with the new revenue.
So that you could basically raise the revenue by allowing them to opt out at that point.
The fire department would have
the revenue to service the area.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Sure.
Yes, Representative Hass?
I guess I see it another way. We're asking the department to recruit new businesses or convince existing businesses to expand. And in some ways, when we ask them to, you know, put some bells and whistles on their recruitment efforts, now we have, we've kind of muddied the waters. Now they have to say to a new business, well, this is the deal for this enterprise zone, although there is this little hitch. And then I can just imagine someone saying, well, what's a special district? What do you mean? It just seems like it takes away the ease of a selling point when it comes to recruiting new business.
I can see how that would throw water on recruiting that new business. However, before you set up that enterprise zone, before the local government adopts that enterprise zone, it's going to have everybody at the table. And then once that meeting program is established, and having come from, and there are others here today that are participating in local government, once you get that local government communication back and forth, then I think what happens is that everybody has a vested interest in seeing the enterprise zone go forward. But if an enterprise zone were to go forward and be adopted by, let's say, Eugene, and there was a sewer district that just says, folks, we cannot extend the sewer to that particular area which you've adopted within your enterprise zone. We can't do it. Physically, we don't have the money. And even if you came up with a $1 billion project out there, it would be, and it's an opt-out, we just can't physically do it. Maybe what happens is that the enterprise comes forward and says, wait a minute, if the difference between us being able to locate in Eugene and not being able to locate in Eugene for this short 3 to 5 year period is the fact that we're not going to have sewer, then why don't we advance the $20, $30, $50 million or whatever it's going to be to service our particular area with the necessary sewer and water, and then maybe make that an enhanced area for everyone involved. So I believe very strongly, I was persuaded by the folks that came forward from Eugene that said, you know, if we can't get everyone on the same page, then shame on us. Maybe we shouldn't be adopting these zones. So before anyone comes there and is attracted to that area, I don't see it as a hitch that happens later. It's a hitch that happens early on, that everyone is communicating and are on the same page. Okay. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I would move the A9 amendments to 3143.
You've heard the motion. The motion is to append the dash A9 to House Bill 3143.
Already. I think the A9 is.
We already put the A9 in?
I think the A9 already is appended to the dash.
Did we do it in an earlier set?
I didn't think we had.
Mr. Chair.
Representative,
I had my hand up, but I thought you'd saw it. Definitely didn't.
Representative Esquivel.
I also share with my colleague some concerns about the opt-out. And let me tell you what I see here is, does this mean that this will carry on over into urban renewals and things of this nature? Will we have a bleed over?
Depends on how well it works.
Representative Riley, your response?
My response is it depends on how well it works. If it works well in one kind of zone, possibly it could carry over. And my example is, it worked well in the vertical housing. So it was part of my reasoning that it's a good thing.
Okay. And
my follow-up?
Follow-up.
Would this include, you say special district, would it include at all any school districts?
No, those aren't. Okay. School districts are not considered part of local government. The local districts.
The dash one refers to section
190. There must be a definition of local districts, the opt-out local districts, special districts, opt-out.
Could we...
See, Nick, can you come forward and tell us what special districts, the definition? Yeah, and there is a motion on the floor. We're under discussion of the motion.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Hasina Squires, on behalf of the Special Districts Association of Oregon, the language regarding special districts, it references ORS 198, which includes the majority of special districts that exist. There are approximately 26 in the state. And so water, sewer, fire, irrigation, ports, water control districts, diking districts, vector control, parks and recreation,
not
libraries.
Schools, not cities, not counties.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you. With regard to the A9s, they still need to be appended. We haven't previously voted on that. Okay. The answer is no, we have not. So the motion is to append the A9, and it's my understanding that there probably is. Is there any further discussion? Let's go ahead and have a vote on the motion to append the A9. Let's do a roll call, please.
Representative Folkland.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Galizio.
Aye.
Representative Kromp?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Haas?
Aye.
And Chair Butler.
Butler votes aye. The motion to append the A9 amendment to House Bill 3143, having received the required majority, is appended to House Bill 3143. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3143 as amended with the A9s to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
You've heard the motion. Discussion on the motion. The motion is to move House Bill 3143 with the A9 amendments appended thereto to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Those in favor say aye. Those in opposition, we'll do that by roll call as well.
Representative Oakland?
Yes.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Felizio?
Aye.
Representative Tom?
Aye.
Representative Oakland?
Aye.
Representative Riley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Haas?
Aye.
And Chair Butler?
Butler votes aye. House Bill 3143, as appended with the A9, is having received the constitutional majority, moves to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. I'll carry that to the House floor. With that, we will close the work session on House Bill 3143. Thank you, Mary. Paul? We'll open a work session on House Bill 3460. Colleagues, it's not my intention to finalize our work session on 3460 today. There are still some amendments, and more than anything, I would like to get a number of issues into the record. We've got a small packet on 3460 that's been handed out to us today, and Representative Haas still had some work that he was working on that we will also discuss in brief form today. So with that, and let's see. Council is here as well, Cindy Hunt. So, if we need council, we can proceed forward. Paul,
Mr. Chair, we can the amendment that I have worked on and have in your packet is the -4 amendments, and there's also the -9 amendments that we have worked on. But there are other amendments as well that are not in your packet, but I'm sure are there out there. The -4 amendments, I'll start with that. It has I just have a little table there that shows you the changes from the original bill. And one change there that I don't have in my chart, but it's more of a technical change, that to work with council on the language about the percent biennial increase, deleted the language that referred to income taxes growing by more than 8% or more than whatever percentage rate is, and refer now to a biennium-to-biennium growth rate in the state school fund. And I'll explain that in a minute. The main changes from the original bill are the percent dedication was 50% in the original bill, and now it's 51%. And the -4 amendments. The starting point was an issue that you discussed extensively and had discussion from the work group on. What the -4 does is take whatever you decide in the next few weeks here in terms of the budget for 05-07 would not be a factor in determining 07-09. The starting point would be based on a 5.318 school fund level. And the amendment itself actually refers to the school forecasting committee and the number that they came up with on December 1. And that's where amendment appears, but that's 5.318 is the number.
That's
the
school revenue forecast committee.
School revenue forecast committee. It's created by executive order. The 5.318 is then you take that for an 05-07 number, and then you add the biennial growth rate. And the biennial growth rate for the state school fund has changed from 8 to 9%, so it's 1% higher. the proportions for the two other funds, and again, this bill makes it very clear that you initially calculate the 51%, then you calculate the 9%, and then you look at the difference between the two. And that difference between the two is divided one-third successful schools fund and two-thirds education stability fund. As you recall, in the original 3460, that was one-half, one-half. So those proportions have changed. There's also another provision in the dash fours on caps. There is a cap on the successful schools fund set at 2%, and my SSF in this case means state school fund. Now we've got two SSFs now, but that's the state school fund. And there is some wording in there that gets a little tricky, but it's in there so that it's 2% of the 9% calculation. So you've got kind of an iterative process there where you've got the 9% calculation, then you'd add something to that, but it would still be 2% of that original 9% growth number. So you'll see some language in there that refers to that. There's also a provision in there for a review, and that review calls for a four-year period. And you can see that if you look, for example, on page 3 of the dash 4 amendments, under section 1, sub 7 there, the Legislative Assembly shall review the percentages used in subsections 2 and 3 to calculate the 51 and 9%, and once every 4 years. So there's a four-year review process built in. And any time there's a change in state or federal law that is projected to result in a significant change in projected personal income tax revenue. So there's not a specific threshold there, but when there's a significant change in state or federal law, then there's a direction to the legislature to review those percentages. The last element here is there is some new language in the successful schools fund. The overall objective is the same, to improve student achievement in low-performing schools and to develop or implement innovative programs. And there's just some clarifying language into how that's carried out. But the basic structure is the same. The Department of Education will adopt rules to administer it, will report to the emergency board on what the criteria is for awarding the grants. Those grants can be carried over from biennium to biennium. So those are the major changes that are in the dash 4 amendments. Then you'll find also in your packets a front and back table that you've seen before on this bill, looking at a simulation. These simulation numbers, they're front and back, so make sure that the top says trend projection with adjustments. And that is looking at a growth rate of a 51% dedication, growth rate of 9%. It also is updated for the May revenue forecast. If you'll notice that the 0507, as you recall, is a plug number. The 5-2 is not has no meaning other than to plug something in there. That number will be determined in your budget process this session. But what I have done with this 5791 is I've taken 5318 and I grew it 9%. But the problem is when I did that, I got 5797. So I'm short, actually, of getting to the 9% growth. So let me remind you, too, that what the bill says is that if you are short of the 9% with your 51% dedication, then the stability fund can be used to bump you above the 51%, but you still have to meet the criteria, the constitutional criteria, to access that fund. So the 5791, the state school fund 9% calculation wipes out the other two funds. So there's no excess available there. And you can see the growth rate that's generated, 9% on local revenue is the assumption we've used. The 10.6 is the overall school operating revenue growth, because we're coming off an artificially a high base than higher than what it actually turned out to be, and that's why you get a 10.6% growth rate. Again, that's calculated assuming that you settle for a 5.2 budget in this biennium. The 09-11 then, and again you see those familiar kind of dynamics we've looked at with the percentages. The income tax growth is trend 11-12%, so that does give you some excess and those funds start to build up. The state school, the successful schools fund grows to is $67 million in 09-11, grows to $116, and then by 13-15 it hits the cap. It's 2%. Of that 7,500 calculation, 7.5 billion calculation in 13-15. So that means that you've got an excess above the 2% of 24 million. You then add that back into the state school fund. So if you hit your cap on your successful schools fund, the overage goes back into the regular operational fund.
So it would be added back and distributed with the 7.5 billion.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. So you'd have, in effect, 7524 to state school fund money to run through the formula. The stability fund, notice, is going to grow faster than the numbers you'd seen before because this is two-thirds of the excess, so it's growing. And I've calculated down below. You can see that in 09-11, you hit the 5% cap at $632 million, and you have $96 million left over for the capital matching sub-account. So those dollars would then flow in, and then, of course, as we talked about before, you'd have to have some additional language on to how that sub-account would be allocated. So, again, that is the neat and tidy world of the trend. And you see how those different funds would build up. If you look at the other side of your sheet there, I built in the kind of a recession that would be fairly severe. Income tax growth instead of 12% in 09-11 is assumed to be 4%. And the local operating revenue, primarily property taxes, dropped to 5%. And you see that the result here is that we can't, with our 51%, we can't hit our 9% target. So what the bill says is you can therefore go above that 51% by using the Education Stability Fund. And so here I've assumed that the legislature gets the 3/5 votes to do that and adds $289 million to the state school fund to bring you up to the 6312, which is the 9% growth. So you're above the 51% for that biennium, but you have to draw $289 million out of your stability fund to do that. And notice down at the bottom, so your stability fund is still getting dollars flowing into it because it's getting the lottery money, the 18% lottery money. So you're getting... out there in 09-11, it's I think $190 million that you're getting from the lottery. So you're able to meet your 9% target. And then I've got an 11-13. I'm assuming we have a bounce back that would be, by historical norms, 18% growth in the personal income tax. And then you notice that you begin to build your funds again with $75 million in the successful schools fund and $152 back into the stability fund, and that balance begins to grow and you hit the cap again in 13-15. You push out the time period before you hit the cap on the successful schools fund, and you only hit it at the end of 13-15 where you have just $2 million in additional revenue. So... that's kind of the mechanics of how the dash fours would work, both in terms of a trend and a hypothetical cycle.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. This dash four amendment comes about as a result of continued work with some of the members of the work group previously and continued desire to try and figure out how the what levels the percentage of personal income could be dedicated and successfully utilized in schools. And of course the cyclical issue is of concern, and that's why we've asked Paul to run a kind of a worst-case scenario by dropping very considerably back in the revenue. That, Paul, how does that...
Not a worst-case scenario.
That isn't. That isn't. And that's what I was going to ask is...
Wasn't quite as bad as 0103.
Yeah. How would that have looked at a 4% projected growth? Weren't we down to a negative except for the borrowing?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. In fact, we were negative with the borrowing included.
Okay.
Our general fund overall declined by 7.7%, I think it was.
Which would have been over 13% had you not borrowed.
Right. The income tax declined by about 13%. So the income tax drop was unprecedented, I mean, in the post-war period. So it hadn't. We think that the capital gains experience we've talked a lot about was the factor that exaggerated that, both on the upside, giving you a artificially high level in 9901, and then dropped it down. So a 4% growth rate in the personal income tax would be a severe recession, particularly, you know, if we were basing it on a 12% trend growth and you build a budget on 10% and you get 4%, you'd be in numerous special sessions in all likelihood.
Paul, if a 4% decline, or that's an 8% decline, from 12.5% down to 4%, is a severe recession. What is it when you drop down to negative?
A very severe recession.
Very severe.
30. Depression, I think we're talking about.
Yeah. It really bordered on that, didn't it? When it goes that far negative.
But the other thing I might add, Mr. Chair, on the cyclical discussion is, you know, I have the property tax revenue dropping to 5%, and we're hearing more and more, and I've noticed that Chairman Greenspan has commented on the real estate potential of a real estate bubble. We do have more downside protection there, of course, than we've historically had because of Measure 50.
Sure.
And the way that our assessed values have departed from market values. But there still would be some downside risk because a lot of our industrial capital in particular is assessed at market value.
Yes, more.
Okay. Are there questions of staff, Representative Galizio?
So we can refer to this as the Warner's recession?
All
right. Yeah. I actually had a real question.
Okay.
And I'm glad if this passes, I'll be able to explain easily at the doorstep how we fund schools. Okay.
You can do that now?
Yeah, we can. Okay. My question is on BITS, the Section 1, sub 7. You know, where it says the Legislative Assembly shall review the percentages that you pointed out, and B says, you know, anytime there's a significant change in federal or state law, so the legislature will then say, the legislature would be in charge of saying that this is a significant change in federal and state law, therefore we must make alterations. It would be the legislature who would do that. Is that accurate?
That's correct, Representative Galizio. Of course, all of this is statutory, but what this is doing is directing the legislature to review this every 4 years, and more frequently if there is a significant change in income taxes, whether it be up or down.
Okay. Thank you.
And I think that one of my concerns, Representative Galizio, when you're dealing with 11.8 billion dollars somewhere. I mean, on the moving from the cyclical. You know, let's stay with the cyclical because it's got the lower numbers. 10 to 15 billion dollars. Anytime you're dealing with somewhere between 10 and 15 million dollars, that's a hundredth point. And that one of the things that I discussed with staff was that I wanted to have some number, and Representative Hass and I had worked on this briefly, to try and come up with a hold harmless. If the federal tax law changes significantly, and the significantly was anything over $10 million, because that would equal 1/100 of 1%, and we were trying to identify to hold harmless, in effect, hold harmless the dedication of personal income taxes to the K-12 program that we're talking about, the funding program that we're talking about here. So that was the number that we were trying to work towards. I want to express appreciation to Representative Hass for bringing that kind of an idea forward. The difficulty we ran into in working with counsel, and Cindy is smiling, not just the Cheshire Cat Grin, but we worked on it to try and figure out if there was any way that we could fit all of those conditions precedent into some kind of language. It just became very, very difficult, and finally we just said, let's just make sure that it's reviewed every 4 years or at any other time that there is a significant change, and that significant change, in my estimation, for the record, we are in work session, but in my estimation was any time that there was a 0.01% change, which would be $10 million or more under the current amounts that we're receiving. Follow up, Representative Gleeson.
Doesn't this undercut, though, one of the premises of the plan that, you know, the complaint is that we always have this cantankerous debate, and so creating some kind of a formula, I thought the idea was to not get it out of the hands completely of the legislature, but to prevent the kind of bickering. So wouldn't this provision simply undercut that whole philosophy?
This provision number one is statutory, and I guess the legislature could, you know, statutorily address it by just saying that provision notwithstanding. But that being the case, it is still a statutory requirement that that you either address it by saying we're going to ignore it, or you address it. And I think that the folks are coming to the table with good intentions to try and make sure that this works. And that's what my aspiration had been here, was to say, let's make sure that it's, first of all, one of the discussions was to take a look at it every 6 to 8 years. Well, I think those things change too fast. And the second thing was, if there is a significant change up or down, let's take a look at that too. And that's recognized too, that if you were to pass significant legislation to increase individual income tax, that this section would be addressed at that particular time. I mean, you're going to have to address it at that time, and you could address that by saying that statutory provision notwithstanding, we're just going to do what we're going to do. But that's going to then bring that back as an item of discussion at that time. You're affecting school funding by increasing it. You're affecting school funding by potentially decreasing the formula. A good question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
If I could speak to that just briefly. It's not so much a matter of the legislature discussing school funding. I think that's something we should do anyway. And if we enact this plan, we certainly need to look at it frequently and wholeheartedly. I think it's more a matter of getting us out of the arguments as to the amount specifically that is allocated for that biennium, so that school districts can go forward without waiting for us to end our discussions, rather than our discussion of how we fund education and whether this is working in a proactive way. With that, Mr. Chair, can I have a question of staff?
You bet.
Paul, explain Section 9 to me. I'm sorry if I hit you with this, but I'm not sure what we're getting at with Section 9. And Section 10 then says that Section 9 is operative on July 11th. Mm-hmm. Of 2011, and I'm just not sure what we're trying to do there.
These sections refer to the interest earnings come from, I see Cindy moving forward, the interest earnings.
Maybe Cindy is the right person to answer this. Cindy, would you?
It's the interest earnings off the statutory language on the interest earnings off the current education stability fund, and those are parceled 75%, 25%. These earnings would go into this account and be retained within the sub-account.
Cindy Hunt, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Currently in our statutes, we have two versions of ORS 348-696.
Oh, that's helpful.
Yeah, and the reason we have two versions is because back a couple of years ago, We had the Higher Education Technology Transfer Fund that was created as a fund and as an account eventually in the Education Stability Fund. And because it was created first as an individual fund, once it was sunsetted, 10 years out because it was felt they might need 10 years to sell off the stock that was in the fund. So we have our two versions of 348, 696, and a couple of other statutes with this 10-year time period because of that. So any time when we go in and have to amend 348, 696 for any reason, we have to amend both versions. And that's when you also see the 2011 date because the second version doesn't take effect until 2011. Now, on a positive good note, there's a bill this session that would eliminate the second version. And that bill, I believe, is sitting in the Senate Budget Committee awaiting action. So if that bill were to pass, there would be conflict amendments probably done between these two bills, and it would work out, and you wouldn't see that second version anymore.
In other words, Cindy, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's confusing because it's confusing.
Representative Berger, that's correct. And it's actually confusing not because of what's going on in this bill,
exactly.
But existing law.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Kalm.
I don't know who can answer this. I would hope it's Paul. But when we first heard this come to committee, the reference was that House Bill 3464 would create a cap on school funding. Is that a correct term for what's still currently happening in this bill?
A cap on school funding.
Yeah. I thought that was in my notes that we received. Mm-hmm.
I don't think I used the term cap. It's a dedication is what it is. I mean, that's the first draw on revenue is this 51% dedication.
Okay.
There is a limit, or you could refer to as a cap, on biennial growth in the state school fund.
Okay.
But you can see how that has been modified by two ways. One is through this drawing from the Education Stability Fund. You can go above the dedicated amount, or through this additional revenue once you've hit the cap for the successful schools fund.
Okay.
So there are modifications to that. But there is a 9% figure in there that would be, my guess would be the main area where you'd see the review, the four-year review would be on that 9%. But remember that applies to the state school fund only, not to the school dedication.
Okay.
So that's the operational revenue. The other two funds are what's going to be, the size of the other two funds are going to be determined by that 9% and the difference between that and the 51% dedication.
Right. Follow-up to that?
Follow-up, Representative.
And maybe it's just a definition or terminology that's in my brain about a ceiling and a floor, because the model that I'm most familiar with is the quality education model. And we have a model for essential school services and then a full implementation. Does that mirror in this plan or not?
Representative Kopp, that is not referenced in the plan. This is really a revenue dedication plan. So
right.
That it dedicates a portion of the incoming stream of revenue and then divides it up into these three different pots that would all go to schools, either the stability fund, the successful schools fund, or the regular state school fund. So that's the way I would characterize it as a dedication, not completely differently than the lottery dedications you've had bills over the last several weeks. We've had one for veterans, one for the college athletics, taking a proportion of a revenue stream and saying it goes to this particular use.
Okay. So I think I follow. So then you would clarify this is not, and help me out here, folks on the committee, that this is strictly a funding bill versus a policy about education.
So far as I'm concerned, it's a funding. It is, in fact, as staff has indicated, it's a revenue dedication for school funding.
Right.
It attempts to approach adequacy, the discussion of adequacy, by coming back and addressing the school revenue forecast committee's number, upper number that they are presently using, and then it attempts to grow that at the 9%. And in that regard, it certainly answers a stabilization, a stability. It would answer, in some respects, the predictability. Again, you're still worried about the economy. But when I notice that my total overall personal income tax resources are going down, then the revenues are coming down under this program, and we have some funds that are available to back us up, assuming that this is successful. And finally, so you've got stability and predictability, and then the adequacy issue is... And this was an issue that we discussed early on in the work group, that the adequacy needed to be addressed in some fashion by saying that the amounts which have been previously dedicated, heretofore dedicated, were not adequate. And if that is indeed the case, and we move to the school revenue forecast committee, that the statutory committee, then what we would do is we would actually be then addressing a portion of that by saying, if the amount which is dedicated is $5.2 billion now, the Revenue Forecast Committee says it should be 5.318. The 5.318 then gives us a starting point for the roll-up that we're working with under the 9. And the 9% isn't applied to the 5.2. It's applied to the 5.318.
Well, and can I respond?
Certainly, Representative.
What you're saying, I totally understand that, even though I don't know if we received all the information from the work committee. I'd love to have the minutes or something of the work committee. But I can't disconnect the actual dollars from policy, how it works through schools and gets to the classroom. But I totally understand what you're saying.
And this is not direct money to the classroom as much as it provides the resource
to help them,
the legislature, come back and attempt to address that in the legislature.
Thanks.
Representative Riley?
I'm also a rookie, and I'm trying to figure something out that you just said, which is the 5.318 comes from a committee which is...
It's a governor's appointed... I think I said statutory. I don't think it is a statutory committee. It is a governor's appointed committee. It has members of many of the different organizations. The governor's appointed, it's the school revenue forecast committee, the group that gets together and says, and there are members here today that are on that.
We did get that earlier in the session.
You commented on this during your initial discussion of this, and so we provided everyone with copies.
Okay.
But the dashboard itself refers to this December 1, 2004 memo, which went to the superintendent.
That's very helpful.
Thank you. Representative Riley, I did misspeak and stand corrected. That is a gubernatorial appointed work group that meets periodically and then tenders this recommendation back to Susan Castillo.
And their charge is to recommend...
Paul, what is the charge? I know.
Mr. Chair, the issue has... Initially, it was created in 1999, following the 99 session. The initial issue was over local revenue, where we didn't have a consistent forecasting system for local revenue. And don't forget that we're still, you know, have a third of school operating revenue comes from property taxes. And particularly in the early days of Measure 5 and 50, our forecasts were off by a fair amount. So there would be quite an adjustment that would have to be made. So the effort was to establish a revenue forecasting group, including the common school fund, including local property tax revenue, timber revenue. And then that became part of the budgeting process for the governor's recommended budget. And they spent actually the last couple of sessions more time in terms of the cost factors that are driving the budget. So they look at student enrollment, weighted students, and they also look at labor costs in particular. And they've made estimates on PERS and health benefit costs and so forth, so they can get a sense of what's the current service budget for the districts, if you would see the districts as a whole.
Okay, so let me paraphrase.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Their charge is to tell us
what's required to keep us at the current level. It has nothing to do with adequacy. It's current level.
That's correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Hess?
Thank you. On this issue, where is it in the amendment that 5.318 is mentioned in the group? And why did we, I'm not saying this is a terrible number, but why at that number, why not, 5.0, 5.4, why not 80% of the quality education model? Where? Why did we select that one?
The answer to the first question Representative Hass is on Section 2, starting on page 3, really the top of page 4. It refers to the beginning of July 1, 2007, the amount identified in the report issued by the School Revenue Forecast Committee. That's the 5318, and you've got a copy of that report. The discussion of where to start grew out of the work group discussion, and I don't know if the chair would want to add to that, or I think it came particularly in discussions with OSBA.
I think that OSBA, OEA, COSA were all have seats at the chair at the table in that school revenue forecast committee, and some of those folks were participating in the work group and felt that was a number that they had come forward with again as a essential budget level for the state school fund, and I think from my perspective, I said early on, fine if we will, if we can't address what the school revenue forecast committee believes that it should be for the essential budget level for the appropriation this session, let's still address it in the process of this legislation. And then allow that number to grow just as if it had been, just as if we had the resources. Recognize that the growth rate is still coming out of the recession, and we're still hampered somewhat by the fact that we're in a rebound. So is that responsive, Representative Hass?
Yes.
Okay. Yes, Representative Riley.
If I may, so once again, this 5.318 billion is what this committee said is the number needed to keep current service levels for the 05-07 biennium.
What the school revenue forecast committee indicated as the essential budget level for appropriation.
Which means the current service level.
I'm not a member of it, and we just have the handout.
Representative Riley, do you have your packet there from the worksheet one outlines the factors that were included and the assumptions that they made to get to the 5318. They included student growth, a PERS rate increase from 11.11 to 15.09. Health benefit increases of 12%, salary increases, including COLAs and STEPs, and inflation on services and supplies.
Okay,
so that's very much a current service type calculation.
Current service as opposed to trying to restore anything that we've taken away in the last few years.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions on the dash four, I appreciate, colleagues, again, the work that's been done by all members. Now we have a dash 9 amendment. Representative Hass, are you prepared to discuss the proposed dash 9 amendment?
Well, I can give you an overview. In a nutshell, they are five separate tax expenditures from our tax expenditure book. One of them would eliminate dividend deduction for corporations, which is seen as more of a federal issue. Another one deletes what has become be known as the peasant life insurance tax expenditure and applies only to corporations A lot of people are surprised to find out that some companies actually buy life insurance for their employees, not with the intent of helping those employees, but to cash in on the benefits when those employees die. And in effect, by buying a lot of this, they can sort of play the numbers. Is that right, Paul? And make out. And I'm not saying that we should judge and make that illegal, but I just don't think we should subsidize that practice.
Is that Key Man Life Insurance? Is that what that is? Is that another name for it?
Yes. It's referred to.
Okay.
The panning for gold, tax expenditure, which is also called a non-fuels mineral, I think, is one, as I understand it, that is given to people who pan for gold as a hobby, but the department has told me that there's no income reported from this. So in other words, hobbyists are using this tax credit off of income, other income, maybe from their job or something else. Again, I'm not saying anything wrong with panning for gold. I just don't know that we should be subsidizing that hobby. It's $3 million a year.
Isn't it a depletion allowance?
Well, there are two there.
There's an individual and a corporate depletion allowance for individuals doing business as and then corporations. My understanding of depletion allowance is that I haven't looked at this representative, so I don't know. My understanding of depletion allowance is based upon the recovery of the mineral. So they have to recover some mineral in order to take a depletion allowance.
One is, I think that may be the smaller of the two. I think it's $300,000. And the other one, I think we're all experts on up here. The one is the political contribution tax credit. It's about almost $12 million in the 07-09 biennium. It says $7.9 million in this coming biennium. I thought it was higher. Anyway, these are five tax breaks. They total $27.6 million in this biennium, and as you can see the revenue chart, they increase through the years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that if we are going to limit education to 50% or 51%, then we need to be more realistic about the increase in the number of tax expenditures we've had over the last decade, which has outpace the growth of schools and the cost of doing the things the state government has to do.
I've not distributed that.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you all had a copy of this.
They have a copy of the amendment and the summary, but not the impact. I'm
okay.
Distributed that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We don't have the impact.
So, Representative. The political contribution tax credit is an individual tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
The mining is broken into both a business and a corporation tax credit.
You're reading for something I don't have.
The back page of the summary of the...
I don't have that.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It was in today's handout.
It should be in today's packet. So.
I'm just looking at that.
That's it.
And I guess I started at the back end of it just because I had it on the back side there. The first one, section 16 and 17, dividends received corporate deduction. So Representative, I'm troubled with the fact that we're talking about individual income taxes, and that's a fairly significant, that seems to be the largest of the, but that's a corporate increase, corporate tax increase.
Mr. Chair, could we ask Elizabeth to
come
forward, because she prepared the summary based on the, and she did spot some differences in the draft versus what was requested.
Okay, Chairman Butler, as far as your question, right, you were asking about the depletion.
That is
pretty small, you know, as far as the portion of the total there. That's, you know, as you're looking at your little summary there, that's the mining component, and that's the 1.098. So, you know, those two, there is a personal and there is a corporate tax component, and they're less than $1 million as far as each year, as far as the revenue impact.
Okay, and that's both as to the individual and to the corporate excise?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, that one depletion component.
So combined.
So combined, okay. Personal and income.
What I'm looking for, and I don't mean to just banner around it, I'm looking for the individual increases that we're talking about, because if we're setting this based upon 51% of the individual, and I'm looking at the corporate tax increases for life insurance and the corporate for controlled dividends, foreign controlled dividends, and for corporate financing and corporate mining, the only thing that really stands out is political tax credit then. I mean, as a major single individual item.
Well, and then you've got the dividend deduction component. So that, remember how we talked all, you know, during House Bill 2542 as far as those corporate dividends are received. And so this
that's
is
corporate to corporate. I'm looking for the individual effect of this, because
that is the political contributions tax credit.
Oh, right.
Uh-huh. I mean, that's where it comes in. So the other individuals are small. I mean, you know, they're just the small mining portion.
Right. Okay. All right. So it's really something for the 0507. Well, let's go out to the 0907-09. About $12 million in corporate or in individual political contributions, and then something less than perhaps $500,000. So you're talking a little over $12 million
right. In
individual increases.
That's
but then
$20
million mm-hmm. in corporate. Okay. All right.
Yeah, that's correct. Now, let me just point out, just so Representative Hastert is clear on what you have in your amendment, you know, what originally I had discussed with council about with the sections 16 and 17 was to try to deal with the dividend deduction, the 70 or 80% dividend received from corporations, and eliminating that deduction that we're allowed here in Oregon, the same as what we have with House Bill 2542 in the future, but then not allow that also the 85% temporary dividend deduction that we would be connecting to with House Bill 2542. So that didn't really get addressed in Section 16 and 17. So what you've ended up with is an add back for these for the income that is abroad of foreign controlled corporations. But then once they would repatriate their dividends back to the parent corporation, they would still be getting a 70 or 80% dividend deduction, providing House Bill 2542 wouldn't become law. So we don't have the connection yet with the dividends received statute in Oregon that we need to address also, as well as then the add back, which you're getting there in Section 16 and 17. And then in Sections 18 and 19, this was not something that I think Representative Haas wanted. This was a personal income tax component, and it in the sense that this was a disallowing that investment income for personal income tax filers. They couldn't claim then that investment income for their life insurance policies. And that would affect a lot of people, and that would have a very big positive revenue impact if you disallowed that exemption. So that was Sections 18 and 19 are really ones that was just an oversight in how council drafted it. Sections 20 and 21 is what Representative Haas was trying to target with the dead peasants, and that's just the corporate component where basically corporations take out life insurance policies on their employees, and then the income that is accrued from those life insurance policies is what they're getting the deduction for. So the other components are pretty, I think, pretty well explained.
So 18 and 19, which would have added back investment income as a additional taxable investment income, would be added back. Would have been that's fully in there. There isn't any.
Yeah, I don't have that on your sheet. You'll notice you know, I just have the corporate life insurance investment income, because that was not what I had hoped council would get in the draft.
Okay. And the Key Man life insurance for a half year, or for a half a biennium, was $3.3 million.
Right.
And 6.6. Now let's see, Elizabeth. That would be based upon the fact that have you taken into consideration the fact that you wouldn't allow the deductions for the expense of Key Man life insurance? Let's see.
Well, that's basically what you're getting, right? I mean, I think that's what, when you have this exclusion, then you're now going to be allowing, making them report that as income.
And then presently there is no deduction for the premium because the policy, when it pays off, has been excluded under Schedule M. What you're talking about here is that you would both leave the deduction of the premium would still continue as a non-deductible premium, but the revenue, which had been previously a return of your premium in effect, mm-hmm. would be taxable.
Right.
Okay. I see. Okay.
It hurts.
Okay. Representative, is that the... I still had the question that this, in effect, would increase the individual amount, the individual income in 2007-09 by about $12 million. 51% would be about a $6 million increase.
Yeah, there was no concerted effort to just do the income tax side or the corporate tax side. You know, one thing about this bill is it may be 51% for education. We still have that, you know, prisons and state
you
police
you
to mm-hmm. deal with on the other side of that.
Which would be the other 49% plus the other $20 million under that proposal. Representative Boquist.
Could you try in farmer's language re-explaining the peasant insurance here? The dead man insurance? I didn't quite understand.
Dead peasant is just key man insurance, key man life insurance.
Go on here. I mean, I didn't grasp what exactly you were saying. What is deductible? Is the premium deductible?
The premium has never been deductible under key man life insurance.
Okay.
Basically, what you're doing is you're investing in something that you can't deduct.
Right.
But when you receive the premium back in the form of your insurance award,
okay.
Then that insurance award is presently excluded back on the back half of back page of the tax return, and excluded because what it is, you've bought something that you didn't get any deduction for. When you receive it back, it's an investment, like investing in land, in effect. When you sell the land, then you pick up your basis back in. Here, what happens is that as you invest in the insurance premium, you would not have any deduction, but when you get the insurance premium back, then you would have income as to Oregon. That's a Schedule M Oregon adjustment, which would be different than federal.
So, well, Mr. Chair, so then hypothetically, as we're saying in 2009-2011, forecasting the $6.6 million in payments by the insurance companies based on people having died.
Well, right? $6.6 million would be basically $100 million in life insurance. At the 6.6% is what it would be, and I'm going to guess that's what you're anticipating is $50 million a year comes back to corporations without regard to size, is my understanding. And I'd have to tell you straight out, colleagues, that I have Key Man Life Insurance in our own family company. So we don't deduct the premiums, and I won't see what happens if I die. I mean, after the party. But if a key man in the company dies, then... Hey, wait a minute. Let's keep it civil. But that's an issue. The key man life insurance policy is... And I'll tell you why we buy it. I'll tell you why we buy key man life insurance. There isn't any on me. It's because we've got some people that are very, very important to make the operation run, as many companies do. It'd be very difficult for me to replace my younger brother in our operation. I'd be hard pressed to take the life insurance that we've got on him and replace his efforts with someone else. And that's why we buy Key Man Life Insurance. But that's the proposal. But
you'd still be able to do that.
But I pay tax on it now.
You would.
We're not outlawing it here.
Oh, no. But I would pay tax on it before I...
You would also be able to do it if you're filing a personal income tax.
Do it if I'm filing... help me with that, Paul.
It's the corporate income tax piece that's limited.
Oh, I see. Right, but if it's...
If you're filing as a corporation, then you would...
S corporation still has it as a Schedule M item, so any LLCs and S corporations, as well as the C corporations, would all be paying an income tax on death benefits, which under federal law have always been excluded from income, and heretofore have always been excluded from state income, death benefits. I mean, we just gave a death benefit to veterans the other day, and federal is considering increasing that. So, okay. Representative Hass, anything further with regard to those proposals? We still have just a few minutes, and I understood that there was a possibility that Lori, can you do that in a few minutes? We've got to be back on the floor in just a few minutes, so I understand that Lori from OEA has another concept. Did you have an amendment? Or
yes, Mr. Chair, I did. The Dash 5 amendment.
Just got a draft.
Okay. For your record, Lori Wimmer Whalen of the Oregon Education Association. I apologize. We thought the amendments were in your staff's possession before the hearing, and they weren't. So we've just been hustling to try to get copies made for you so that you'll all have them. But I'll start with them.
And Lori, these are the Dash 5 amendments?
These would be the Dash 5 amendments. They would be characterized as the Oregon Education Association's amendments to the bill. And by way of background, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'd just like to explain that these amendments are in answer to the question of what would be the absolute minimum the Oregon Education Association and its 43,000 members would need in order to be able to support House Bill 3460. So these amendments answer that question. And I gave the chair, and I think several of you have also seen it, kind of a hand-engrossed list of issues, and I'll very quickly go over those because the amendments address the substance of those concerns. As we discussed in our work group, we believe that having just a cap on education funding, I know it's been described as a little bit differently, but from our perspective, a cap on education funding was not the intent, that in fact it would be more of a funding floor. And we believe that funding floors without a ceiling or without a range end up becoming de facto funding ceilings. So we wanted to see expressed in the bill both a funding floor and a funding ceiling so that it's quite clear that there are a range of options depending on the relative effort of the state and its ability to provide those funds. So it is our proposal that it be expressed as not less than 45% of the general fund as a floor, and the ceiling would be expressed as the full implementation of the quality education model. We also felt that there needed to be a higher starting basis. You know, responsive to the question asked earlier regarding the school revenue forecast on which I sit, the original essential budget level or current services level, if you will, estimate that the school revenue forecast committee proposed as of June 2004 was the $5.4 billion level that most education advocates have said is the minimum needed for 0507, for example. And I will tell you that that was changed downward to the lower number only in November 03 on the basis of the argument. Well, there were two pieces. One was the proposed expected increase in local property revenue, but also the other piece was a renewed assumption that employees would bear the brunt of most of the health insurance premium cost increases that could be expected in the 0507 biennium, and they made that downward adjustment over our objection as an organization. They lowered the assumption from 16% increase assumption down to 12, and that's a pretty significant piece of business that you need to know about because that's part of the negotiations in this building about what an adequate or at least a whole harmless maintenance of effort level would be. So that's just to clear that up for your record. 5.4 was, from our perspective, the true essential budget level if you don't begin from the position that employees should bear the brunt of that cost increase. So we do start with that as our starting basis. We also believe that the percentage each biennium should be tied to the general fund and not simply personal income. And the reason for that is that we believe that public education should be a shared responsibility of the entire community in Oregon, and this is a pretty vital point to us. And we believe that the personal income tax is, of course, the strongest horse in the stable, as your staff has pointed out, but it's sometimes a wild horse. And we also believe that given that corporations benefit from the well-educated workforce, there is a nexus there, and they ought to be contributors to that education enterprise as well.
We also believe and agree with the notion that the school improvement fund, which is what we prefer to call it, should be capped at the 2% of state school fund, and that's in our amendments as well, with the excess reverting back to the state school fund. And I'd also like to point out that we already have in statute a bipartisan agreed upon, education advocates all supported, law called the School Improvement Fund. And we don't need a new name and a new layer. We have one in statute now. Let's just use the one we've got. If we're going to have a fund that helps schools improve and achieve and close the gaps and do ever better with students, let's make sure that we are relying on those elements and criteria that were agreed upon by all of the players at the table and not very distant past. It was passed in, I think, the 2001 legislature after a lot of work by people such as then-Speaker Lynn Snodgrass and her education leadership team, and there was an education summit, and there was a lot of work done by a lot of smart people to develop that. So we prefer that we reference that, and our bill does on our amendments. And so when you hear, you won't hear successful schools fund from you, hear school improvement fund, but it's the analogous cost. Also, we believe that the growth cap, we leave it at the 8%, but we do a comparison against the 45% of general fund and pick the higher of the two in any given year so that we don't have a ratcheting effect if inflation erodes the ability to keep pace with inflation. So then we pick the funding floor as the higher of the two. We also, let's see, what's the next item on the list? We also struck the language in the Successful Schools Fund language of the original bill that tied everything to the No Child Left Behind Act. Again, we believe that the better use is the language already in Oregon statutes around the School Improvement Fund. We also added that local options ought to be expanded to permit districts who are able to, if we go to the floor level of funding, that local options could backfill, but only to the difference between the ideal, the ceiling, and the amount that's actually appropriated, so that you have an enhanced local option element there. And finally, we've asked that in the ballot measure 1 report, which passed, I think it still holds the record as the ballot measure that got the highest number of votes of any, so the public strongly supports education accountability, that in that report that's required of the legislature after each biennial appropriation, that both the essential budget level as determined by the School Revenue Forecast Committee and the quality education model developed by the Quality Education Panel, and finally the actual appropriation, all be discussed and compared in the Ballot Measure 1 report so that we have full transparency and budget accountability with respect to how the actual K-12 appropriation is described to the public subsequent to any appropriation. So those are the elements that we asked the Legislative Council to draft for us, and those will be found in the Dash 5. I'm happy to answer your question.
Thank you, Lori. Questions? Representative Berger.
Yeah. Have you got what your remarks in a form that so that you were pretty complicated there, Lori, and it's hard for me to come up with a question relating to the first part when I'm still trying to understand the last, because I just didn't get all that ballot measure 1 business at all. My question goes back to, have you run numbers to show what your 8% and how it compares to the 25% over time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, we have not yet had any runs done on this amendment. I just got it today.
Okay.
And with respect to your comments, I will be happy to provide them in writing.
Thank you. That was help me.
Thank you. Further questions of Lori? Thank you very much, Lori. And if you'll provide that summary to all of us, that will give us a good place to start.
I will.
Thank you very much. And colleagues, with that, it is 3:00, and we're scheduled back on the House floor. We'll close the work session on House Bill 3460. Thank you, and we'll close revenue for the day.
Thank you, young lady. You're welcome.